Welcome to a very special edition of Onc Live On Air. I'm your host today, Caroline Seymour. Onc Live On Air is a podcast from Onc Live, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Onc Live covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. Today, we had the pleasure of speaking with Howard A. Skip Burris III, MD, FASCO, FACP, and Stephanie L. Graff, MD, both of Sarah Cannon Research Institute, to discuss the impact of COVID-19 on patients with breast cancer, the transition to telemedicine, the protocols their institution has put into place to reduce potential exposure to the virus, and some of the work HCA Midwest Health has been a part of regarding COVID-19 prevention and management. Additionally, Drs. Burris and Graff shared some of the resources released by the American Society of Clinical Oncology for patients during the COVID-19 pandemic, explained how the Society has leveraged its platform to help reestablish cancer care and research, and discussed the ultimate decision to make the 2020 ASCO annual meeting virtual. In our exclusive interview, Dr. Burris, Chief Medical Officer and President of Clinical Operations at Sarah Cannon Research Institute, 2019-2020 ASCO President-elect, and a 2014 Onc Live Giant of Cancer Care and Drug Development, and Dr. Graff, Director of the Breast Program at the Sarah Cannon Cancer Institute of HCA Midwest Health, and Associate Director of the Breast Cancer Research Program at Sarah Cannon Research Institute, discussed how the pandemic has affected cancer care, the collaborative efforts made between Sarah Cannon and HCA to increase access to investigational COVID-19 treatments, and the steps ASCO has taken to ensure its members' professional education and well-being during this time.
Thank you so much, Dr. Burris and Dr. Graff, for joining me here this morning. So my first question for you, what data do we have to date, be it anecdotal or otherwise, regarding the impact of COVID-19 on patients with breast cancer?
With breast cancer and COVID-19 really depends on the geography in the country or in the world, because there's been very different rates of COVID-19 infection and different impacts on geographic health systems as a result. But for the vast majority, there's been an opportunity to really continue cancer care to our usual standards and our usual practice. We've been lucky to see several new drug approvals for metastatic breast cancer throughout the pandemic. And so it's exciting to see that science and cancer care has really continued forward at the highest quality. Of course, some regions, as they surge, have had to take breaks from business as usual in order to focus on treating the pandemic. But a lot of regions have been able to continue forward and really sort of not miss a beat in our commitment to the highest quality cancer care.
And I'll just add to that, it's been interesting to see the different attitudes among the patients. Certainly as March went along and we moved into April, we saw a bit more fear. I would say those patients that had started adjuvant or neoadjuvant therapy and were in a curative setting were eager to be safe, but also to get on with their treatment. And I think we saw those patients that were in the metastatic setting, particularly those that had to travel a bit, entering into discussions about how they might delay some of their visits and what would be safe to do in that regard. We attempted to ship out pills where practical, and we can talk about moving to some of the telemedicine visits. But then also, I think we took some great steps to try to alleviate the fears by thinning out the clinics, moving out the routine surveillance visits, trying to be able to socially distance by how we scheduled the clinic to try to give the patients a more comfortable environment.
So then, has Sarah Cannon released any specific guidelines for prevention or treatment in the COVID-19 era?
I'll start by saying, as Chief Medical Officer, we made a decision to stay safe but stay the course. So, Sarah Cannon, we knew that, in fact, our systems were going to be greatly reducing much of their routine health care. So, continuing with emergency room care, of course, participating in COVID care as it depended on the various levels of positivity in markets, but also continuing on with cancer care where possible. And so, Dr. Graff and her team coordinated a number of meetings with our physicians across the network. We very much followed the guidelines that were issued nationally. We thought CMS and the National Cancer Institute, among others, as well as the FDA, all came out with some very good guidance about how to keep patients on trials and take appropriate deviations. We followed and passed out the CMS guidelines with listed cancer surgeries as a tier three proceeding where possible, as long as the patient could be safe. And so really some credit goes out to the national societies. We did the same thing with ASCO. We can talk more about that, really following some of the national guidelines, which we thought were very appropriate.
With NHJ and Sarah Cannon, I think that, you know, from the very top of our leadership, Dr. Burris, Mr. Hazen have adapted a policy of just transparency and communication. And we've been hosting town halls to keep everyone on the cancer care team, whether that's medical oncologists, radiation oncologists, surgical oncologists, navigation, across the various different tumor types to address the unique needs of those programs. So for breast oncology, addressing issues around screening mammography, benign breast disease management, options around treatment and management of invasive ductal carcinoma. But as a part of those discussions, they've also been able to keep us informed on how our health systems are practicing increased safety, heightened safety and awareness, access to personal protective equipment, and really have been able to communicate with us very clearly that we have been positioned in a really successful position to be able to continue to provide the best care for patients, and have sort of already started thinking down the road for how we reemerge beyond the pandemic stronger so that it's safe and we don't miss a beat kind of bringing patients back into more of a traditional healthcare environment. The other thing I would add is that HCA was also very adaptive in getting us pretty broad global access to telehealth capacity, whether that was telehealth for the outpatient setting so that we could minimize patient flow through our clinics and through the hospitals, or even telehealth capabilities for inpatient care so that patients that could maybe, you know, so that some of the subspecialists didn't necessarily need to go into those rooms, but they could use telehealth capacity to still provide high quality consultation services with remote access to at-risk patients.
Now, before we get into more about telemedicine, I wanted to ask if you could talk about some of the work HCA has been a part of regarding potential treatments for COVID. I was reading earlier that you were involved with the FDA Expanded Access Convalescent Plasma Protocol.
Yes, we were. And a great credit to our team for being able to participate. One of the things that's unique about Sarah Cannon and HCA Healthcare is the scope and scale. So reaching across 24 states, 186 facilities, and getting into some of the geographies that are in the middle part of the country have been very important to bring those types of therapies to patients. Dr. Graf was very involved with the committees that got that rolling. Dr. Graf, maybe you want to say a few words about how the program rolled out?
Yeah, the HCA research team and the Sarah Cannon research team were able to collaborate together to open the expanded access protocol for convalescent plasma. The intent is to continue that protocol through 2021 as we watch how the COVID-19 pandemic evolves and changes across the country. And both organize, you know, quick access to convalescent plasma for patients whom it is clinically appropriate in the context of a clinical trial where there's appropriate data collection and above all, patient safety is a consideration, but also in a way that allows us to coordinate donors because patients and persons who have recovered from COVID-19 it's really heartening to see how many of them just want to make a difference for somebody else who maybe is newly diagnosed or struggling with COVID-19. And so having that support and again, the depth and breadth of the HCA network, being able to coordinate that effort has been really powerful. I think a lot of other systems across the country have been experiencing that similar sort of camaraderie as we go through this. Healthcare has become a global team and it's exciting to be a part of.
I'll just add, we've also been participating as appropriate in some of the antiviral trials, such as the remdesivir studies that have had some press, and certainly that work will continue. We've also been engaged in some of the testing trials, so looking at means to get faster tests and more accessible tests to determine positivity for patients, which we think are key. And then lastly, we've established a registry. While we have not had many facilities be inundated with patients across the whole program, we've had several thousand patients that have been infected. So the database that we're building through our registry is really going to give us both some current and some longer term insights into how those patients were treated and which patients seem to do better with certain therapies. So that information we plan on continuing to monitor and publish and present appropriately as it evolves.
So then what has the transition to telemedicine been like for you?
You know, as a frontline community oncologist, HCA was very adaptive, being able to bring telehealth into our facilities. Federal agencies like CMS and the FDA have been very adaptive and forward-thinking in allowing for a broader, more non-traditional approach to telehealth than previously. And patients have truly embraced it. That I think, you know, obviously there's hiccups as everybody works from home. We've all learned the hiccups of work from home and telehealth and telecommuting. But globally, I think it's been a really great experience. A lot of my patients just really enjoy having that connection, that face-to-face human moment, even if it's not physically in my clinic. It's been fascinating as a clinician to see my patients in their home environment. I've met kids that I've never met. They're normally in school during the parents' appointments. I have met pets. we've shown off home decor and home painting and all different sorts of projects that are going on in their backgrounds. They've been excited to talk and share. So it's been a really fascinating window into the world of my patients that I'm privileged to have gotten to see. I hope moving forward that we're able to figure out ways to continue to use telehealth adaptively, particularly to broaden access to clinical trials. I mean, that's always been a mission of Sarah Cannon, is bringing trials to the people where they live in the communities. And to be able to continue to expand that would be a really powerful thing to come out of COVID-19 if we're able to use this momentum moving forward.
And it's interesting, the varied responses of patients. So I think of two specific examples where an older woman, breast cancer, lives down the street from the clinic, probably a mile or two from our office, sitting back in her recliner, big smile, cup of coffee in her hand, and said, "Now this is the way to do healthcare." And she was very excited about the telemedicine visit. And then really the patients that needed it for certain, that lived an hour and a half away across the state line in Kentucky, worried about the travel, very hesitant to get into the technology, very hesitant to get into the video conferencing. So, you know, that rural versus city dynamic is going to continue to play out. And it kind of goes to that broader issue as telemedicine evolves. And as Dr. Graff alluded to, for even helping with screening and participation in trials, we're going to need to continue to work on how the rural patients can participate.
Now, shifting a bit, obviously, ASCO has a huge platform. How would you say the society has taken advantage of this to help reestablish cancer care and research?
So basically, we've done this through trying to get information out there and trying to connect. When you get down to what ASCO does for many of our members, it really is around education and connectivity. We have put out on the ASCO.org website a bunch of frequently asked questions that have really come in from our members and got appropriate expertise on answers. We've gone from a few thousand to more than 250,000 page views weekly over the last month, so that's been impressive. And the cancer.net site has had similar resources for patients. Being able to ask frequently asked questions and having experts comment on things such as simple as masking and how patients should feel about traveling and continuing their therapy. We also have started a registry, which is a bit different than some of the other registries that other societies are doing. This is really to look at the longitudinal impact of COVID-19. We're asking practices to participate. Sarah Cannon is signing up as an institution, as well as a number of our community practices, really trying to ascertain the longitudinal effect that this crisis, this pandemic, is going to have on cancer care. And then last, I'll just comment, we are moving. Obviously, the big annual event in Chicago, a bit sad, but we are excited about the virtual meeting. A lot of work has gone into the virtual meeting. It will be provided free to members, and we are going to give the scientific session as scheduled that first weekend, end of May, early June, and then we're going to move the educational sessions to a separate weekend in early August. So a lot happening on the front of trying to still provide that content to our members.
Now, of course, this will be the first virtual annual meeting for ASCO. So what were kind of some of the events leading up to that ultimate decision?
Well, I think the most important thing overall was the discussion about the comfort and safety of our members. And that is a large gathering, north of 40,000 individuals attend the meeting. It's there in Chicago, obviously at McCormick Center. And really, early times, end of February, early March, really wondering how quickly the pandemic would pass. Then we quickly moved into the scenario where we saw that the severity and the depth of the pandemic was greater than we anticipated, and we had to think about our international colleagues and how quickly it was looking like they would not be able to participate. And then within just a few days, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers beginning to mobilize centers like the McCormick Center in Chicago and the Javits Center in New York to be overflow facilities. So it became clear at that point that our members would be most comfortable with a virtual meeting. We also are a big event each year for releasing the latest clinical trial information, the latest data. And so we know that clock ticks and that a variety of individuals, from patients to researchers, the pharma biotech companies, are all waiting to either hear or present their information. So we felt that it was critical to keep that timing in place, and thus became the move and really a great effort by the volunteers led by Dr. Melissa Johnson, one of Sarah Cannon's research leaders, who is this year's scientific program chair, to begin to come together. And really the teamwork was simply amazing. Everybody went full forward, no looking back, and really got the program in excellent shape. And I think we're excited about what the product looks like as we head into the meeting.
Now, could you highlight the goals of the COVID Impacts Cancer Initiative? And Dr. Graf, how do you see that this might, you know, supplement the efforts that are being done on institutional levels, such as Sarah Cannon?
I'll let Dr. Burris address the COVID Impacts Cancer Initiative. But, you know, as a ASCO member, as a consumer of the ASCO product, ASCO has been just remarkable in their response to COVID. They have very quickly adapted their website to take direct questions from the community on how, you know, things that we're struggling to determine, and get that sort of national leadership perspective on approaches to COVID-19 in cancer care. They have very quickly mobilized around consensus statements and updates. Very recently, ASCO leadership published an ethics position paper on scarcity of resources that is going to be really vital as we move forward through these times. And they also have cared for us as physicians and cancer caregivers in updating resources around mental health, physical health for the care force as we continue to work through this. And just knowing that our professional society is caring for us in all the different ways that it means to be a professional, whether that's our education or our well-being or our questions and concerns on the front line, has been really meaningful for me as an ASCO member.
And as Dr. Graf mentioned, the education has been a key part. We are seen at ASCO as being a trusted voice for this information, to be a society that actually is truth-seeking in terms of the information that's passed out. And so the resources have been important to provide. Same is true for our reputation at the Capitol, in Congress, and on the Hill, providing information into lawmakers so that they understood exactly what the impact is, which quickly led to a number of initiatives, and one, the gathering of data with the registry, but also to provide real-time information so that physician practices were included, much like other small businesses, into the payroll protection plan, and looking at the CARES Act to make sure that we looked at some of the legislation around START, for example, and have some waivers and allow hospitals to be able to help out practices, particularly smaller practices, where possible. Also looking at the patient side of it and making sure that, in fact, we provide information and support to the federal agencies so that telemedicine, while not perfect and a number of the rules needing to be lax at this point, that we mostly made it accessible to provide continuity of care, and we'll use it as a learning experience to really define how telehealth should work moving forward, to encourage the use of deviations and to look at some exceptions to allow clinical research to continue. All those dialogues with CMS, the FDA, and the NCI have been very, very critical. And interestingly, I think we're taking one small step toward modernizing the clinical trial process with some of the events that have happened during the pandemic. So in general, ASCO has been there to be a liaison, a conduit, a voice during this time to advocate for cancer patients and cancer physicians and make sure that we stay safe but stay the course and try to take care of these important patients.
Now, you mentioned the ASCO registry earlier. Of course, there are a number of registries that have been launched recently. I was speaking to Dr. Warner earlier about the COVID-19 and Cancer Consortium registry. So could you discuss the decision to launch the ASCO registry and kind of where that'll, you know, fit into the already busy landscape?
Yes, I think it's important. We have actually at ASCO reached out to all of the societies, so reached out to societies such as the American Society of Hematology, the Oncology Nursing Society, the American Cancer Society, to make sure that everybody was aware of our intentions with the initiative. Dr. Warner, one of the leaders in the CCC19 registry, also looking at trying to see how we can merge some of that data and make it useful. But it was clear that while there are these time point registries going on, that ASCO wanted to take on the responsibility of the longitudinal view. So actually, it'll be an evolving database, not a single point in time, built really among the principles that came from the CancerLink database so that we know what's going on with these practices and we know what's going on with these patients. We will be focusing on those patients that are COVID positive, but the data that will come in will also tell us a little bit about the effect of delays in care, what we're seeing from a volume perspective. We know that we're seeing fewer mammograms and fewer colonoscopies and fewer screening CTs. So to get that overall cancer aspect that will be broader than COVID-19. And also taking the long view that while we're in this crisis phase, while we're in this sprint portion of this pandemic, we know that COVID-19 is going to be with us for a while. Hopefully our new therapies, vaccines, and the like will minimize the impact. But we know that this will be something that will be a bit of a seasonal event and that we're going to have an impact as we move into the fall and as we move into 2021. So again, taking that longer view, I think will be important information. And again, looking to partner with these other registries and share data. We've been very clear that the information will be transparent, that we're going to publish on a real-time basis, so there'll be frequent updates. And hope that that information will be useful to not just our members, but really to society as a whole.
Is there anything else that I didn't ask that you wanted to highlight?
I might ask Dr. Graff to comment on the mood from the town halls that she and some of our leaders have been leading across Sarah Cannon. We have felt the need to bring these groups together and have had some well-attended weeknight meetings virtually that's really shown the engagement of the cancer care providers.
Yeah, I think that our town halls have really had a very collegial tone to them. I think that there's been a really great dialogue across the Sarah Cannon network nationally around best practice and ways to safely provide cancer care in the time of COVID. Physicians clearly remain deeply committed to optimal care of cancer patients. And I think that for most of our markets, although there have been lots of cases of coronavirus, there haven't necessarily been the numbers that led the health system to need to stop providing cancer care. And so I think, you know, we have another round of town halls scheduled for next week. And the plan is really focusing on how to bring people back into healthcare. And I think that would actually be kind of the parting comment I would want to make, is that I think that the country has done a great job with social distancing and hand hygiene and embracing this unusual new normal. And it's time for us to continue to focus on our health as humans. And so I think that this is a great opportunity for everyone to figure out if they're due for their screening mammogram or their screening colonoscopy, or, you know, if they have symptoms that they've been ignoring or healthcare needs that they haven't had met over the stress of their normal lives. And if this pandemic has been an opportunity for them to embrace health, I think most healthcare systems in the country are getting to a place where we're ready to open our arms back to the full health of the people we serve. And so, you know, obviously that's going to be different geography to geography based on cases. But for the most part, I think that this is a great opportunity for Americans to refocus on health. Just like they've refocused on walks in nature and so many of the other cool things that we've seen happen as a result of the pandemic. It's just sort of that shift in our mindset. And returning to healthcare is going to be another important part of that.
I appreciate you both taking the time to speak with me this morning.
Thank you very much. Important conversation. I'm glad that ONC Live is providing this information out to all of our colleagues across the country.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to ONC Live On Air. Check back on Mondays and Thursdays for recaps from our State of the Science summits and exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. ONC Live is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at ONC Live and ONC Live SOSS. On Facebook, like us at ONC Live and ONC Live State of the Science Summit, and follow our ONC Live page on LinkedIn. If you like today's episode of ONC Live On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you are there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to ONC Live On Air.